From Clearfield to Port Allegheny, Saxonburg to Ridgeway, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, officially it is known as the Redevelopment Assistance Capital Program, but RCAP is actually a slush fund for funneling state tax dollars into lawmakers' favored projects. State Representative Andrew Lewis is here to talk about potential reforms. Public transportation is expensive and controversial. Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi have an Allegheny Institute report on why the Port Authority Transit in Pittsburgh is one of the most expensive such systems in the nation. And occupational licenses are more often a way to keep people out of a job rather than get them into one. Ashley Klingensmith of Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania explains on this week's Lincoln Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to State Representative Andrew Lewis in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. Pennsylvania will be in the presidential campaign spotlight again over the coming weeks. Both President Donald Trump and Vice President Mike Pence will appear at a campaign rally on Wednesday at the Giant Arena near Hershey. It is the president's first visit back to Penn's Woods since he spoke a few weeks back at a Shell gas conference in Pittsburgh. Meanwhile, Democrat candidates for president, including frontrunners Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and Pete Buttigieg, will all speak at a public education issues forum in Pittsburgh on December 14th. While climate change alarmists continue to predict the arrival of doomsday, actual statistics show greenhouse gas emissions in Pennsylvania have actually declined. This according to a survey conducted by the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection. Net greenhouse gas emissions in the state dropped by nearly 19% between 2005 and 2016. Despite the fact the state is making progress on its own, Governor Tom Wolf wants to entangle the Commonwealth in a regional greenhouse gas initiative known as REGGIE that would place significant new regulatory restrictions and expenses on state power generators. Lawmakers are fighting the plan, saying it actually is a tax which cannot be enacted without legislative approval. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Pennsylvania spends hundreds of millions of dollars each year funding special projects in legislative districts across the state. This is done through the Redevelopment Assistance Capital Program, or RCAP. But critics say it is little more than a legislative slush fund. Some reforms are being proposed. Here to talk about them is State Representative Andrew Lewis of Dauphin County. Andrew, welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal.
Andrew, first of all, the RCAP program, explain to us what it is and why it was originally set up.
Yeah, so the RCAP program, or the RACP program as it's commonly called, is the Redevelopment Assistance Capital Program. This is a Commonwealth grant program. It's administered by the governor's office, by the Office of the Budget, and it's essentially for the construction of regional economic development projects. Mm-hmm. So it's the construction of a lot of these projects. These companies or organizations will apply for grants, and they'll then obtain an RCAP grant. So the governor's office administers the program, but the legislature actually authorizes the amount of debt, because a lot of these projects are actually financed through capital debt. So it's the Capital Facilities Debt Enabling Act is the legislation that authorizes the debt to cover these projects.
So what we're talking about here, it's not money, tax money that's coming in that is then appropriated back out.
Right.
You're actually indebting future generations of Pennsylvanians to pay for this.
Yes, you are. So it's essentially, when this was started, even at its inception, it was started with a debt ceiling of $400 million. So you're talking about a program that's essentially saying, hey, it's almost like a credit card. Like, hey, there's a credit card here where we're going to borrow basically to pay for development projects, which, look, there are a lot of worthy economic development projects and, frankly, a lot of worthy projects that were undertaken through the RCAP program. But ultimately, what happened with the program was it ballooned out of control. So that debt ceiling started out at $400 million, and it ballooned by 2010. It was at over $4 billion, which is insane.
Tell us a little bit more about how these projects are selected, because critics of the program will say it's little more than the old walking around money that used to be handed out so that legislators could curry favor with voters by funding special projects in their districts. So is there a more competitive process for these dollars now?
So it is a little bit more – I'm happy to report it's more transparent than it used to be. So it's not just a matter of politicians getting walking around money that they can throw around their district. A lawmaker will endorse an application. It then goes forward and potentially can get approved or not. And so the actual application process is somewhat complex, but it ultimately people from around the state will apply. They say, I want an RCAP grant. They've got to match the funds. So if you apply for $1 million RCAP grant, you're matching it with $1 million in private investment. And then ultimately it goes forward and that project gets approved. And there's input. There's input, by the way, for these projects by all four caucuses. So Democrats, Republicans in both the House and Senate, and then the governor's office all come together and ultimately provide input to get these approved. And then it's administered through the Office of the Budget.
Talk a little bit about the type of projects that are funded. I imagine it's a fairly wide variety of projects.
Sure, a lot. So one project that received an RACP or RCAP grant was Harrisburg University. So the local, it's a nonprofit local university. Then you have, I think there were the Hershey Med, I want to say there were some RACP grants. There's been a number of, like I said, good projects. Certainly, I would warrant a nonprofit university to serve underprivileged folks is a worthy use of the program. But then there's other projects that, you know, whether it's maybe certain community centers and just there are other things that I don't think the metrics, some of these projects, I don't think the metrics are there to show that they've really been had a positive impact on the local economy.
I can recall a few years back, a soccer stadium was built to try to lure a professional soccer team to Delaware County.
Oh, my goodness.
Which, of course, is right outside of Philadelphia, so not the place you would expect a professional soccer team.
Yeah.
So some of these projects, as you've noted, are clearly worthy. So why then do we have this process and not have a process that's similar to a lot of, like, there are a lot of different grants through community development grants and things of that nature.
Yep.
Why have this separate from those type of grants that are more not only competitive, but the requirements for the grant are a lot more stringent?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's something I think we should be taking a hard look at. So I came in to office, obviously, this January, and one of the first things I became aware of was just how high this debt ceiling had ballooned. And so my first priority was like, look, this is problematic. This is unsustainable. When you're talking over $4 billion, and we've been reducing it, the Republican-led legislature has been reducing it over the years, but that reduction was set to expire. So to your point, maybe it is time to take a look at changing the way a lot of these community and economic development projects are funded and move away from RCAP, maybe move toward a different type of process. But my first and foremost, kind of like the saying, you gotta plug the leak before you can bail the boat out. So my goal in this is, hey, let's get the leak plugged and let's start to bring this debt ceiling down.
We are talking with State Representative Andrew Lewis. He, of course, from Dauphin County. We're talking about the Redevelopment Capital Assistance Program and dollars that flow through it. So you have proposed some legislation. Tell us a bit more about what it is that you think should be done to start, as you put it, plugging the leak.
Absolutely. So ultimately, the debt, like I said, the debt ceiling ballooned under Governor Rendell up to over $4 billion. Now, if you were to adjust, you could say, look, in 1986, $400 million would, if you were to adjust it for inflation, it's significantly more than $400 million. But I actually ran those numbers, and it's still less than $1 billion in today's dollars. And so yet, we were four times that. And so what my bill, which is House Bill 880, does, it amends the Redevelopment Assistance Capital Program provisions of the Capital Facilities Debt Enabling Act, which is the overall governing act that authorizes these funds to be borrowed. And basically it says, look, starting July 1, 2022, because currently there is a reduction going on. It's $50 million a year, but that expires in 2021. So mine picks it up where it left off and says, not only are we going to reduce it by 50, we're going to reduce it by 100. And so we're going to reduce it over 5 years by $500 million to bring that debt ceiling back down, which would be the debt ceiling amount at that point would be about $2.65 billion. So that's what my bill does. I got it out of committee. Thankfully, I was able to get it passed on the House, both second and third consideration. So it then went to the Senate, and now it's in the Appropriations. I hear you laughing. Does that mean you – so it's in the Appropriations Committee in the Senate.
Well, the Senate is the Senate's an area where sometimes good ideas go to die. We have seen many good pieces of legislation that have passed the House, have gotten over to the Senate. And even though Republicans control the Senate, things just don't quite go the way they should over there. Although, as we all know, there's been a big change in the Republican caucus in the Senate over the last couple of years with a lot of the more left-leaning senators from the southeastern part of the state are gone.
And more we've a conservative body, more of a proactive body in there now.
Well, we've also seen some of the more moderate members from other parts of the state be replaced with more fiscal conservatives. So this will be a good test case.
Yeah, for sure. I'm optimistic. And I think there are multiple ways to attack this objective, which is to drop the debt ceiling. I know there's the amendment process as well. Maybe they shoot a bill over and we amend it on concurrence and shoot it back over and say, look, we'll vote yes, but you better cut this debt ceiling down. There are ways to do this. And we're going to be exploring all options.
Is there still that strain of we need to take goodies back to our district? And every lawmaker wants to see their district get their fair share of state tax dollars. But there still is the overall perception of this being sort of a bit of a slush fund, if you will.
Yeah. And that's what concerns me is I don't believe there should be taxpayer-funded incumbency protection programs, for sure. I think that go out there and fight for good policies, but don't indirectly buy votes by ultimately bringing pork dollars to your district. I don't think that's what a lawmaker's role is supposed to be. At the end of the day, it's about responsible governance and fiscal responsibility because the people funding this debt are the taxpayers. The money belongs to them. It's not the legislature's money. It's the people who sent us to represent them in the legislature. That's who it belongs to.
If this does pass the Senate, you've mentioned it's already passed the House. If it passes the Senate in the same form, it goes to the governor. Have you had any indication from the governor or his people as to what they might do?
I did. So during the committee process, we were able to have them neutral. So they were neutral on the bill. They didn't come out against it. And I think that bodes well for its chances of getting signed. I think he would be very hard-pressed to say, well, I need this debt ceiling to be as high as it is, especially with the reduction effort that's been happening over the last few years. So I'm optimistic he'll sign it. Optimistic we'll get it done one way or another, and I'm encouraged that it did pass the House.
We are talking with State Representative Andrew Lewis. He represents the 105th Legislative District. That, of course, in Dauphin County, Pennsylvania, we've been talking about some proposed limits to spending under the state's Redevelopment Assistance Capital Program. Andrew, listeners would like to learn more about your legislation, more about what you're doing. Where can they find you on the web?
Yes. So if you go to replewis.com, that's my official website. You can also go to at Rep. Andrew Lewis on Facebook and follow me there.
State Representative Andrew Lewis. Andrew, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Westmoreland County is considering a major change to how it provides bus service. And Allegheny County's public transit system is one of the most expensive to operate in the nation. We get details from Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi on this Allegheny Institute Report.
Hello and welcome to the Allegheny Institute Report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal. I'm Eric Montardi. Joining me today is the Executive Director of the Allegheny Institute. Let's talk some transportation issues, specifically mass transit here in western Pennsylvania.
Not reindeer sleigh driven.
Well, that is a form of mass transportation as well, I guess. Everybody's looking forward to that at the end of December. Obviously, there's been a few little bit of news coverage that the legislature says they're going to start to look at transportation issues holistically. I guess we can talk about roads, bridges, highways, mass transit, everything that comes with it. The issue, of course, with the turnpike and its funding of transportation costs that are not related to itself. It sounds like the General Assembly might be doing something in 2020 to take up that issue. But let's look a little bit closer to home. As we know, there's always a state funding component to mass transit. So there's issues that go on at the state level that then affect the mass transit agencies here and in other parts of the state. But let's talk first about the Port Authority and its recent data update on its bus costs and what you found.
Right. We've been keeping an eye on the Port Authority of Allegheny County's mass transit system, specifically the bus system, for a long time now because it's obviously an expensive proposition. And of course, as you mentioned, it's not just funded by those riding the buses through fare boxes or even the property taxes or in this case, it's our local drink tax that funds its portion of Port Authority Transit bus systems. But we also have the Turnpike component and the state local state match of local funds component. So, you know, there's a lot of revenue streams that go into the transit system here. And so we ask the question, well, how expensive is it? Now, as you said, we updated a study from last year. And so this year I looked at Port Authority and nine other systems, cities like Columbus, Cleveland, Kansas City, Cincinnati, Indianapolis, St. Louis, Charlotte, Milwaukee, and San Antonio, just to kind of get a flavor for, you know, how expensive is it. And when you look at the total expenses off the top, Port Authority of Allegheny County's expenses come in at $301 million. Now, the average for these 10 systems, including Port Authority, is only $134 million. So you're talking well over $160 million plus difference between the Port Authority and the average of these cities. The next highest city is Cleveland at $163 million. So Port Authority seems to be way out of line just on an aggregate basis. Now, of course, aggregate basis can be a little misleading because these authorities are all different sizes. They run different lengths of routes, pick up different levels of people, and run different hours. So we looked at it as expense per mile. If you take those total expenses divided by the revenue miles, and the Port Authority does about 21 million revenue miles a year. San Antonio beats them with 22 million revenue miles, but the Port Authority's total expense per revenue mile comes in at $14.30. The average for this sample is $9.63. Again, Port Authority's largest by far. The next one down is again Cleveland at $12.75. So, you know, you have quite a disparity just in operating cost per revenue mile. Now, again, that's just the length of the system. So, okay, let's look at the number of revenue hours. That is the number of hours that the buses are on the road picking up passengers. You know, they're running their routes. How long does it take them to do that? Again, the Port Authority has 1.6 million revenue hours out there. Second to San Antonio's 1.65 million hours. The average in our sample is a little over a million revenue hours. And so you look at the expense per revenue hours, and Port Authority comes in at $185.91 cost per revenue hour. Again, the average for this sample is only $123.69 per revenue hour. So the Port Authority is very expensive when you compare to this sample of similar size cities. And so you're looking at a system that's terribly expensive. And of course, the obvious question is, well, why? You know, what's the main driver in all this? And of course, we get back into this notion of their costs, mostly their operators, their bus drivers, and wages and fringe benefits. And what was kind of interesting here, when you look at the wages for the Port Authority of Allegheny County, it's $60.1 million just in operator wages and salaries, what they're paying their bus drivers. Interestingly enough, the fringe benefits earned by these same folks are $70.6 million. This is a case where fringe benefits paid are actually greater than the wages earned. Now, only one other city in our sample does that, and that was Columbus. Columbus operator wages were $30.8 million, and the fringe benefits paid are $31.5 million. For the rest of the systems in this sample, the other eight, their wages are higher than their fringe benefits. Now, this goes back to something we've been keeping an eye on for a long time, and that is, of course, the legacy costs incurred by this transportation system. You've got tremendously expensive pension plans. You've got tremendously expensive, what do you call it, OPEB, other benefits, excluding pensions. And so you've got this tremendous legacy cost for this system that really is not going to go away anytime soon. This is something that will eventually, hopefully, diminish over time. But when you look at why is this system so expensive, there's your smoking gun right there. We've always paid more fringes than we are salaries. And of course, you know, this gets into our recommendation of at the state level, there's a law that allows transit workers to strike. And as a result, these transit workers have the upper hand on the Port Authority and any other real bus system in this state when it comes to negotiations. They can just walk out and leave all the riders stranded. And that's a tremendous power that really they should not have because it can gridlock and shut down an entire city. And of course, that has led to these particular imbalances in costs. So one of our recommendations is for the legislature, hey, let's remove this this right of transit workers to strike.
Yeah, and that's a recommendation we made for some time, and for some reason it just doesn't go anywhere. It's surprising. Let's go a little bit closer to home here. Another brief that we worked on, available at our website, which is AlleghenyInstitute.org, is on the Westmoreland County Transit Authority. Now, years ago, when the Port Authority was going into one of its contract negotiations and there was talk of a strike, the opening foray by the board of the Port Authority was to say, we're going to contract out 20% of our operations. And what that meant was basically they wouldn't run them in-house. They would put out the bid, a certain portion of the service, and take bids, and whatever the lowest responsible bid was, they would have taken it, and those folks would have operated the buses or, you know, whatever other transportation mode at the time. That never happened. But this Westmoreland County Transit Authority was really interesting because since 1978, when it was created, it was never allowed to directly operate a bus system. Basically, you had a authority, you had a board, you had state and local funding that's provided by municipalities in the county and Westmoreland County itself. And then they would just engage contractors to go and drive their buses that they owned. They did this for 40 years. This is going to end at the end of 2019. And then starting in 2020, it's going to be a whole different transit system because basically what's going to happen is this Westmoreland County Transit Authority is going to become an operator as well. And this only happened because the county commissioners and then the board changed the articles of incorporation. There was language in there from 1978 that said the authority is directly prohibited or prohibited from directly operating a transit system. That was amended in June, so the door was open there. And so now they're going through a system where their procedure or process where they're hiring workers, they're going to be bringing them in-house. They're going to be the ones that are going to be responsible for the negotiations rather than it's a contractor who has its employees, and if there's a labor issue, it's kind of their thing to sort out. Now it's going to be a board, you know, that is going to have, you know, public meetings and sunshine laws and everything else that it's responsible for. And right now they extended the contract, which will go through March of 2020 as they bring these workers on board. Interesting stuff as always. So on behalf of Frank Gamrat, this is Eric Montardi. We invite you as always to visit our website, which is www.AlleghenyInstitute.org for information on transportation and other issues that we cover. For both of us, we wish you happy holidays. And this has been the Allegheny Institute Report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal.
Efforts at reforming professional licensing requirements are moving through Pennsylvania's General Assembly. On this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary, Ashley Klingensmith from Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania explains what such licenses are and why change is needed. Ashley?
Earlier this year, after the Arizona Senate passed a universal occupational license recognition law with bipartisan support, Governor Ducey tweeted, "Looking forward to signing this legislation to make Arizona the first state in the nation to recognize out-of-state licenses for people who move here." Shortly thereafter, Ivanka Trump retweeted and commented, "Excessive occupational licensing harms economic mobility and hurts low-income workers." At the state and federal levels, people agree. We've got to start removing barriers for incoming workers. Occupational licenses are a series of laws and regulations that require individuals to obtain government permission through mandatory fees, training, and other requirements before engaging in certain professions. By restricting who enters professions and how they operate, licensing laws in turn affect the cost, availability, and quality of goods and services, as well as the economic livelihoods of millions of people. These laws were sometimes enacted with good intentions, often in the name of public safety, but in reality they have often become a way for special interests to limit competition. In fact, numerous studies indicate that occupational licensing laws do not improve health and safety outcomes, and at times even produce worse results. Consider restaurants. Subjecting restaurants to things like inspections has worked just fine, with food prep staff and chefs needing no license to ensure the public's health. Mechanics aren't licensed, but there are standards for vehicles operating on the roads. These inspections and standards are outcome-based policies that should be our demand from government when it comes to health and safety considerations. Instead of a license, which isn't really a guarantee of anything, competency or otherwise, but rather simply a government stamp of approval in the form of a permission slip. In Pennsylvania, over 19% of workers are estimated to be licensed, or nearly 1.1 million workers. Over $9.4 million in deadweight economic losses and $368 million in misallocated resources can be attributed to occupational licensing laws here in PA. The Institute for Justice found that 20% of PA's low to medium income workers require a license. We license 51 of the 102 lower income occupations tracked by Institute for Justice, which makes it the 31st most broadly and onerously licensed state. These figures, though, can be personalized through the stories of Pennsylvanians who put a face to the harsh reality of these statistics. Amanda Spillane was finally getting her life on track. She'd gotten hooked on drugs as a teenager and had committed several crimes and landed in prison for 2 years. When she got out, she was determined not to waste the rest of her youth. So she moved back in with her parents, started working full-time at McDonald's, and spent nights attending cosmetology school so she could have a career. She became passionate about cosmetology and even got a job offer at a salon before she finished school. But when she applied for her cosmetology license, the board slammed the door on her dreams. They claimed she lacked good moral character because of her past offenses and was unfit to give facials or tweeze hair. She was shocked, heartbroken, and out of a job. In PA, we are addressing this question through legislation. We've just seen Senator DeSanto and Senator Schwenk Senate Bill 637 pass the Senate with unanimous support, and now it's been referred to the House Judiciary Committee. Representative DeLosier and Representative Harris's companion legislation is scheduled for a Judiciary Committee vote on December 9th and should receive consideration before the full House the week of December 16th. This legislation requires that boards only withhold a license for convictions which are directly related to the practice of the occupation prior to ever withholding a license. What else can policymakers do to address burdensome occupational licenses? Well, they should pass reforms that provide a presumption of the right to practice a given profession under the law, placing the burden of proof squarely on the licensing boards to demonstrate the necessity of licensing. To find us on Facebook, search at PAAFP and on Twitter by searching at AFP Pennsylvania. I'm Ashley Klingensmith, State Director for Americans for Prosperity.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 24 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WBHVAM in Somerset, WEMR-FM in State College, along with WMBS-AM in Uniontown, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations. They include the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.
Thank you.